WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Studying with Allen Ginsberg, William Burroughs, and Gregory Corso sounds like it would have been the hippest education imaginable for a college student who devoured beat literature. Let's just say the reality wasn't quite what Sam Kashner expected when he left his parents' house in Long Island in 1976 to enroll at the new Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics. Located outside Boulder, Colorado, the school basically was the English department of Naropa University, which was established by a Tibetan Buddhist meditation teacher. In his memoir, When I Was Cool, Kashner writes about getting close to the beat writers who had been his heroes. Kashner also is the author of Sinatra Land and is a frequent contributor to Vanity Fair and GQ. When I Was Cool has just been released in paperback. Terry spoke with Sam Kashner last year when the book first was published. Here's a short reading from the beginning of When I Was Cool.
What I didn't quite realize as I packed my bags for the Kerouac School was that Ginsberg, Burroughs, and the rest of the Beats were on the downward slope of their fame. 11 years earlier, Allen had been crowned King of the May in Czechoslovakia. William Burroughs' Naked Lunch, considered a classic novel of nightmare comedy, was nearly 20 years old. Because the core faculty had turned their autobiography into art, their fictional selves lived on in a kind of perpetual youth. But, as I would soon discover, they themselves had grown old. The Beats I would encounter at Naropa were long in the tooth, cranky, full of bowel complaints, and the perils of advanced age. I came downstairs. My parents had a present for me, waiting for me in the car. It was my father, Seymour Kashner. He would be coming with me to Boulder to see that I got settled in okay. My father going with me to the Jack Kerouac School? In the midst of my happiness, another crisis. I felt the cold hand of embarrassment on my shoulder. Just for the weekend, my mother said. With so many secret fears of what life among the Beats would be like, I was secretly relieved. I'd have my naked brunch at last. But it would be with my father at the other end of the table, eating Baskin-Robbins.
That's Sam Kashner reading from his new book, When I Was Cool, My Life at the Jack Kerouac School. As we can see in the reading that you just did, you were intoxicated by the young Beats who were on the road and who were writing their classic fiction. You weren't prepared for the older versions of them that you encountered when you went to Naropa. How had Ginsberg changed with age from the image that you had in your mind?
Well, the Allen Ginsberg that I came to Naropa expecting to find was very, very different. I wanted the, or thought I had wanted, the outrageous beatnik, the, as Gregory Corso once called them, the commie, sex-crazed, stoned beatniks of the 50s and of legend. And instead, I found someone who had almost institutionalized his legend, who was looking for a way somehow to kind of hang up his beat sneakers and somehow come in off the road. Someone who was, to some degree, I don't want to say trading on his reputation, but who was beginning to sort of codify his fame and his reputation and to somehow lean on the legend. I found someone who was a copious keeper of files. I mean, down to the files. He kept files on the pets of his friends: Gregory's cat, Bill's hound dog. I mean, they all had their own files, and with Bill Burroughs, the same thing. I thought I would be encountering this great sort of junkie of legend, and instead I got someone who was walking with a cane. So it was a real cold bath for me. I expected a much different kind of crew.
How did you first find out about Naropa and the Jack Kerouac School?
I saw a copy of, possibly the only copy extant of the catalog for the Jack Kerouac School.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at it, and it had a picture of Allen Ginsberg and Bill Burroughs and Gregory Corso on a bench, on a park bench. And this was the core faculty. And I just fell in love. I felt I had to go there. I had to be there. And it was like, you know, it was like being a painter and being able to sort of, you know, study with at a school with the great masters, you know. I just saw myself as the fourth man on the bench, you know. I didn't realize at the time there was no room on that bench for a fourth person, you know, even if you weighed 98 pounds.
Would you describe your first meeting with Allen Ginsberg when you got to the Kerouac School?
Sure. It was in Boulder, and I went into sort of a student-teacher apartment complex that the Jack Kerouac School had reserved for what I thought was the school, which turned out to be Allen, Bill Burroughs, Gregory Corso, Anne, and myself as a student. And I saw Allen, but he was practically undressed. I mean, he was wearing boxer shorts, and he might have been wearing socks. And he was very comfortable in his own house and sitting at a large, in his breakfast nook, which was really just a glass table with a couple of kind of overwrought iron chairs, as as Bill Burroughs called them, you know. And he didn't have his beard, which just completely threw me. And with that slightly kind of charming but crooked mouth of his, he just didn't look like Allen Ginsberg. He looked like an eighth-grade science teacher.
One of the reasons why you went to Naropa as opposed to a conventional college was that you didn't want to deal with shared toilets in a dormitory. What was your problem with that?
Well, I was just kind of particular. And, okay. You know, I'm sort of a throwback. I'm like Oscar Levant when it comes to, you know, personal hygiene. And so that was a real obstacle for me, going to a conventional college. I tried it. I tried going to Hamilton College in Clinton, New York, when it was an all-boys school. And I certainly wasn't prepared for beet hygiene, which
I can imagine. I was thinking, like, how could somebody who's so obsessive about personal hygiene even think about being part of beet culture?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that was another revelation, really. I mean, but I did have my own plays, and Peter Orlovsky, Allen's lover and companion of more than a quarter of a century, was a fantastic housekeeper, you know. But really, it was difficult. But I also, in a way, was completely unschooled, even in taking care of myself. When Allen would give me his laundry to do, I went through a brief period where I was sending it home to my mother.
You're kidding.
No, absolutely. In giant sort of UPS boxes. And this poor, lovely woman out in Merrick, Long Island, was having to do Allen Ginsberg's laundry, you know.
I mean, why didn't you do it yourself?
I probably just didn't want to touch it, you know. I didn't, you know, I had to do it. I could have actually taken it to a laundry.
I was going to mention that next.
Yeah, I know, Terry. Yeah. But it was, you know, I was kind of so sheltered that I was almost only related to my parents in some way. I was like a kind of feral child in that way, you know. I mean, I didn't do it for the entire 2 years, but I realized when I was doing it how absurd it was and what an imposition. And also, Allen was grumpy about why he wasn't getting his laundry back fast
So he didn't know.
No, God, no. I never told him either.
Sam Kashner speaking to Terry Gross in 2004. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2004 interview with Sam Kashner, who studied with beat poets Allen Ginsberg, Gregory Corso, and William Burroughs.
Part of your job, in addition to being Allen Ginsberg's apprentice, was to take care of Allen Ginsberg's people, to take care of his longtime lover, Peter Orlovsky, to take care of the fallen poet, Gregory Corso, to take care of William Burroughs' son, who was an alcoholic, who was suffering with cirrhosis of the liver. How did you feel about being handed these responsibilities for broken people?
Well, at the time, I'd romanticized the Beats so much that it really took years and the writing of this book, essentially, to kind of understand how broken or lost they were. At the time, I was just sort of treading water, trying to kind of stay up. I was really just trying to deal with one incredible crisis after another and keep what I thought was my cool, you know, literally and figuratively. I would lurch from crisis to crisis with Gregory, for example, who was much more of a serious junkie than William Burroughs, another sort of revelation. And then there was Peter's confession that he, after 25 years with Alan, was in fact felt that it was just the power of Ginsberg's personality that had sort of overwhelmed Peter, and that what in fact he really wanted to do was to live with a woman and have a baby. I mean, these were a lot of things to sort of lay at the doorstep of a pretty unformed teenage kid from Long Island.
In the passage that you read for us, you write about what it was like to encounter Ginsberg and Burroughs when they were older men, as opposed to being the younger men of their early, now classic, literature. And you wrote that they were long in the tooth, cranky, full of bowel complaints and the perils of advanced age. How did they deal with those perils of advanced age? Would they sit around and complain a lot about their bowel disorders and about, you know, all the problems that they were having related to their aging?
Yeah, I mean, Alan and Burroughs in particular, after a lifetime of junk, to his horror, Bill Burroughs realized that he was dealing with constipation. You know, he said had he known how constipated he would have become as an old man, he would never have gotten involved with heroin.
So they don't tell you that when you're young.
No, they don't. Isn't that a shame? And
can you imagine the public service ads for that?
Yeah, that's it. That'd be great. Yeah. So Burroughs was obsessed with his bowels. Gregory, who was only in his 40s when I knew him, constantly referred to himself as a toothless old man, as a kind of medieval hag. And he looked like that in a way. I mean, he really did look like he had just stepped out of a Bruegel painting with, no upper teeth and this kind of wild hair. And, some of it was just financial. I don't think he could afford dentures. And Alan, too, was a kind of biddy about sort of taking his medicines at the right time and whether the tea was too hot or the tea was too cold. I mean, he was a magnificent complainer.
Yes, you call him the whiner who howled.
The whiner who howled, yeah. Yeah. Although, you know, I was a little ashamed to write that when, you know, you realize how bravely and magnificently he handled his own death.
I'll just say something about my relationship to Allen Ginsberg
as a
fan and sometime interviewer, mm-hmm. which is that, you know, I'd see him and I would just be in awe of some of his performances and of some of the things that he'd have to say about life. And then one time I'd interview him and he would just kind of gas on and it was hardly usable because it was just so, like, overly wordy and speedy and not really saying much of anything. And then I would talk to him another time and I would just be amazed at how insightful and interesting and full of feeling his conversation was and his writing.
Right.
And he just seemed to, in that sense, kind of embody both. And it was always worth hanging in there because, like, the wonderful Ginsberg was so wonderful and so and so unique.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, there was something also, do you think, almost kind of rabbinical quality.
Absolutely,
about
his,
you know, both his genuine sort of joy in life, his wisdom, his very keen, almost Proustian sense of observable detail, which I think he and Kerouac sort of shared that, the idea that, you know, the kind of shapeliness of mind, how you would sort of write as you think, that somehow your writing should resemble a kind of natural shapeliness of the mind. But, you know, if you talk, it was my impression, even back then, that if you talked about that kind of thing for too long,
mm-hmm.
you can just, I mean, it's like ether. You just would put the room to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And also people with butterfly nets would start to chase you, you know. I mean, there's just there's a certain amount of that, that one can take, and then you really do lose your audience, you know.
Now, Allen Ginsberg was gay, and you write in your book that, you write, I wanted Allen to love me without taking me to bed. Did you feel it was hard for him to love you without taking you to bed?
Oh, gosh. That's such a good question. And I wonder. I mean, I always thought that the really good-looking guys later, when there were more students that had come to the Kerouac School, when I sort of survived my apprenticeship and made the world safe for the Kerouac School, for other students to come to the Kerouac School, I think that I noticed that if you were really good-looking, Allen really liked your poems and kind of championed you. And so I spent a lot of time kind of getting dressed and groomed and ready for my classes with him, you know, and my one-on-one poetry workshops, because I wanted him to like my poems, and also I wanted him to sort of fall in love with me. I mean, I felt like, in a way, a great lineage would be falling in love with me at the same time, you know, that I'd be sitting on, it was like sitting on Walt, on Whitman's lap, you know, on Uncle Walt's lap. So I did want him to love me, but I wanted him to love my work and love the enthusiasm that I brought to my job as a kind of sorcerer's apprentice, you know. But because we didn't sleep together and it wasn't a sexual relationship, I'll always wonder about that. I mean, I think that if, in a way, I wondered if the relationship suffered because that didn't happen. But there's no way of knowing that now.
There was a meal that brought your two worlds together when your parents took you and Ginsberg and Peter Orlovsky to a deli. What was it like to have those two worlds come together?
Well, it was two things. It was kind of a nadir and a sort of summit all at the same time. I mean, it was a nadir of embarrassment. My mother and father meeting Allen Ginsberg and Peter Orlovsky, and yet the fact that they were in my company and in my parents' car was just an almost unbelievable joy, a kind of great triumph. But then, of course, you know, the worlds collided when it was someone's idea, I think possibly my mother's, that we all looked sort of undernourished, and I realized that my father was heading for Ratner's on the Lower East Side, where we were all going to be eating vegetarian chopped liver together, and I wanted to die, you know. But at the same time, I had this just indescribable thrill and joy and feeling of triumph. At the same time, I wanted to just disappear.
Well, you know, I don't know if you ever feel this way, but sometimes you're one way around one group of people and a slightly different way around another.
Right,
the way
exactly.
One is around one's parents isn't always the way one is around, say, Allen Ginsberg. So,
no, I would say not.
Yeah, so did you have to figure out who you were going to be during that lunch?
Well, that's what was so horrible. I almost don't remember the lunch because I was, it was actually kind of very, very late dinner, because I really felt like I was going to sort of pass out with kind of quandariness about who and what I should be. What I didn't realize at the time, you know, was that Allen was very much like me. I mean, he loved his father. His father also drove him crazy, his father, Lewis, and he adored his stepmother. And one of the first things he did when he sold his papers and finally had a lot of money at the end of his life is he set his stepmother up in a kind of beautiful apartment. You know, it's exactly the kind of thing I would have done if a college wanted my papers and gave me $1 million. So in a way, we were very much alike, but we were just both too, I think, shy and embarrassed to admit it.
Sam Cashner, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Sam Cashner speaking to Terry Gross in 2004. Cashner studied with beat poets Allen Ginsberg, Gregory Corso, and William Burroughs. His memoir about that often surrealistic learning experience, called When I Was Cool, has just been released in paperback.